Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
One thing that Doug makes sure he has at all of his restaurants is dimmers. Dimmers for like every light. And that's like his keyboard that he plays throughout the evening.
I spend more time dimming lights than, I think, I mean, and whoever's managing, dimming lights and changing the volume of the music is key. I mean, we ran around to restaurants all over New York with like tape measures and cameras and stuff and just looked at like, I mean, look at Balthazar. What's the dimensions of these tables? What makes this work? Where are the lights in relation to the top of the bar?
Here back with us are Ryan Angulo and Doug Kroll, chef owners of two neighborhood restaurants in Brooklyn, Buttermilk Channel and French Louis, and the authors of the cookbook Kindness and Salt, Recipes for the Care and Feeding of Your Friends and Neighbors. So let's get right into the cookbook. First of all, how did it come about? Like, why now? And here's the real question. How much help did you get from your wife? The glorious Laura Tucker.
She basically wrote the thing. Ryan and I took a trip to Japan, and Laura wrote it all down. I'm so grateful to her.
So really, though, how did it come about?
How did the book come about? Appropriately enough, in our community. I met the editor while I was dining out. I think as we were talking about last time, packed into a tiny New York restaurant, it's easy to meet someone. And the woman sitting next to me at the communal table ended up being the editor for the book. And our agent was dining at the restaurant.
So. Oh, right, because he lives in Brooklyn, David Bly.
He lives in Brooklyn, yeah. Well, we would only do business with a Brooklyn guy.
We got to parse the title. Let's talk about kindness and salt as a concept for a book. Let's talk about kindness.
It's a big part of what we do. It's an important part of what we do. We certainly couldn't have a cookbook just like I think nobody should have an experience at our restaurant without feeling touched with, by a genuine relationship with us. And we try to be kind in everything we do in our relationships as a staff and also with our customers. So that would have to be a part of our book. It's part of that's our philosophy. And the salt is, sort of shorthand for just cooking
with flavor.
Cooking with flavor and cooking with common sense and cooking with salt, literally.
But the juxtaposition is unusual, but that's why I like it. It's like, because the kindness speaks to the emotion and the salt speaks to the flavor.
Yes. And salt has a double meaning too, because, sometimes we all get a little salty.
Right. That's true.
But yes. But yes, the salt is referring to the flavor.
And now let's move on to the subtitle, which is the care and feeding of your friends and neighbors.
Yeah. I mean, I love the subtitle. Doug came up with that really, like, almost instantly. That was, like, our working title for the book pretty much since the beginning. Kindness and Salt came later. I don't know. I just think that's great.
It comes from, if you Google care and feeding, I don't know who did it first, but it's like, handbooks for taking care of pets mostly. But that
I know. In fact, this could be the title for a cat hostel.
Exactly. But I feel like that nicely encapsulates what we do, care and feeding of our friends and neighbors. Like we said, friends, which could be from all over the place, or neighbors from all over the place.
I feel when I go to your restaurants well taken care of. And I don't even tell you that I'm coming. Which apparently Laura says you're annoyed by, but...
we want to know. We want to make a fuss.
But people do feel well taken care of, and it's amazing what that does to people. It sort of disarms them, and they will tolerate many more things. And I mean that. If they have to wait 15 minutes for a table, or if the steak comes out medium well instead of medium rare... If they feel well taken care of, it's okay. If they don't feel well taken care of, it's not okay.
Yeah, we can.
That's very true.
Customer this weekend put a fine point on that. They said, they said, oh, yeah, you could totally screw this up and we'd still be happy. Don't worry about it. You build up goodwill with people. Yeah. Try not to abuse it.
Sometimes it happens.
Well, you eat at a place, 100 times, which hopefully people will at ours. They're not going to like something.
It's not a perfect science. Cooking,
yeah.
At least not in my kitchen.
And how much of the menu changes? Like, there's things that you can't take off the menu, right? Like fried chicken is always going to be on the brunch menu,
part of what I think makes the menu successful is that we don't change everything. That, like, you know, 10 years from now, you can come back and get that steak frites you really like, you know, or that fried chicken that you had, you know, and it's exactly the same. But then, you know, there's the people that come in more often, and just for, you know, us personally, just to change things up, we change about, I'd say, like 35 to 40% of the menu, you know, seasonally.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, like, that other half that, like, never changes.
I mean, that's the way people eat in restaurants. They both want variety, and also you go back again and again and again for the same thing.
You know, Danielle Boulou always talks about, I can't take the potato-crusted sea bass off
never.
The menu.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I would love to, but people come and they expect it to be there, whether they order it or not. They somehow feel comforted that it's there.
Yeah, that was like when I worked at Picholine, the horseradish crusted salmon, Terrence Brennan's signature dish. I think he grew to like not like it very much, but we always had to have it, always.
A dish that both Ryan and I have personally prepared.
Yeah,
we both worked in that restaurant at separate times.
That's
I was
funny.
On that station making that fish.
We almost crossed paths.
That was a really good restaurant of its time.
Mm.
I've heard he wasn't the easiest guy to work for. Are you guys screamers? Are you a screamer, Ryan?
No, not at all. Well, it depends. I mean, you have to really be doing something like that's just really idiotic and just not respectful of the food or the restaurant to really make me mad.
Got it.
But on a day-to-day basis, no. I don't walk around yelling. And I know a lot of chefs do. And that's kind of like one of the biggest things I learned from working in kitchens is what I didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I became a chef, and that was pretty much one of them.
Used to be most of the great chefs were screamers because they learned under screamers, and screamers beget screamers. But somehow, do you feel like the tide's turning a little, or do you still think there's a lot of screamers?
I think it depends on the kitchen.
Yeah.
I think it still depends on the kitchen.
I mean, in our industry and in many industries, the workplace is changing for the best, and I
right.
think that's part of it.
Yeah.
It's a weakness, screaming.
So you're, Doug, although you're trained as a chef, you're not cooking at either of the restaurants now, right?
No, never was. It would definitely be a bad day if I am in the kitchen.
Did you feel it was important that you had training as a cook to be a successful restaurateur?
I you know, I fell in love with food and then restaurants and then assumed that I would therefore be a chef and was as far along as culinary school and then cooking at Picholine before I realized that I didn't like it and never would. I loved working in restaurants and I loved hospitality and really enjoyed showing people a good time. But I was never going to like doing that. So I got out, started working in dining rooms.
Were you actually ever the head chef at a restaurant?
No, not close. Nothing. Only a cook.
In the book, you talk about the door as almost a metaphor for many things. So talk about the door.
I mean, the person at the door, you know, has this dual responsibility. One is just friendliness, but the other one is this sort of mad air traffic control situation where you're trying to shuffle everything around and make it work and promise people they're going to sit down in 15 minutes and they really will, or an hour and a half and they really will. And that's a really special position. I think of that person as being second only to the chef as far as making the whole thing
Yeah,
go.
And it's so hard to find that right blend of air traffic controller and welcomer.
My wife has got it.
Yeah.
She's never worked in a restaurant before. She does it at the front of the house every Sunday.
I knew before you even said that your wife has it.
There's different ways of going about it. And I wrote about two of them in the book, about Ellen at French Louis and Jennifer,
yeah,
my
so
partner
talk about
at Buttermilk
that.
Channel.
You talk about Ellen. She's the Southerner.
She's a Southerner, yeah.
And so she has this very Southern notion of hospitality and greeting people.
Yeah, she gets to say y'all too, which is just that's a special power all in itself, you know. That just transmits something friendly
it's
to
true.
People.
True, and when people from New York say it, it really sounds lame.
I want to. It's totally lame. Yeah, no, it's not ours. But come on in, y'all. And it's like, oh, you're right.
I tried it for a while. You know, we have a great pastry chef, our pastry wizard, Stella Parks, also known as Brave Tart. And she's from Lexington, Kentucky. Nobody says y'all like Stella Parks. Okay, I'm just telling you that right now.
Makes you feel good, right?
It makes me feel great.
You want to give it a shot right now?
I can't do it. I don't know.
I can't do it either.
I can't do it justice. It's like she's just got the lilt. It's the lilt and the way it.
Yeah.
It's sort of one syllable, but it's kind of two, and it's it's kind of weird. So you also talk in the book about setting the stage. What to you constitutes setting the stage at a restaurant?
Well, the stage would be the dining room for us, which hopefully is not a stage for much drama, but a stage in that it needs to be set. So we're talking about lights and music and the things that that give people the feeling that they want to have when they're in a restaurant. I mean, just candles alone, which we write about, are a thing that. I think the candles may be like the y'all of ambiance of restaurant dining rooms. They really give you a feeling. There's a warmth to them, that an intimacy that they bring, and bringing people together over that flickering flame that you can't get otherwise.
But what's funny about your restaurants is, I once talked to Steve Starr about the lighting at Upland because it's beautiful. He said, oh, yeah, well, we hired one of the best lighting designers in Paris to come and do it. So I'm just guessing, I don't know this for a fact, Doug and Ryan, you didn't have the money to hire one of the best lighting designers in Paris, so you just made it up.
No, but one thing that Doug makes sure he has at all of his restaurants is dimmers. Dimmers for like every light, and that's like his keyboard that he plays throughout the evening.
I spend more time dimming lights than, I think, and whoever's managing, dimming lights and changing the volume of the music is key. And we went around to restaurants all over New York with like tape measures and cameras and stuff, and just looked at look at Balthazar. What's the dimensions of these tables? What makes this work? Where are the lights in relation to the top of the bar?
You were searching for the elements that create magic, which are really hard to identify. There are some concrete things. You talk about the width of the common table. And so you would just walk around listening, looking, and
measuring,
lighting.
Which people get suspicious when you break out a measuring tape. I got kicked out more than once. Just like, wow, what are you doing there? But how do you make a bar that's nice to eat at? Well, you got to have room for your legs to slide under it, and you got to have a light where it can shine on your book but not create glare.
This is fascinating. So what's the magic of 30 inches?
I it gives you a little extra space. It's enough space to work on with food that you're sharing, but not too much that you start to feel distant from people.
Yeah. Keith McNally is a setting the stage genius in the restaurant business. I mean, the light itself that emanates from Balthazar in the evening is magical.
He really makes magic. And those places, they give you the illusion that they've been there forever, or that they evolve from something else, and they're in fact created out of whole cloth.
Yeah, it's true. It's fascinating. But you did this yourselves. I mean, you might have brought Lauren or friends, but you didn't have the money, so you were setting the stage without a stage designer, without anything.
Well, for French Louis, we had some help.
Got it.
We had Joseph Folia. He's a restaurant designer, and him and Doug designed the restaurant together.
That was a game changer. That was real. Yeah. That was a real luxury. Like having a real pro who knew what he was doing.
Right. Yeah.
He created lights and light fixtures just for the restaurant. He had those metalwork guys, and they were created out of brass. And
it's
beautiful.
Funny, but it's interesting. A lot of diners don't notice the lighting, and that's because if it's right, you don't notice it, and if it's wrong, it's glaring.
But glare is usually the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, and so. That's why I asked Steve Starr about Upland and Justin, the chef. Similarly, it's like, wow, this lighting is just stunning in here. And Steve Starr, it's no accident.
Yeah.
That was a very expensive.
You're correct.
Yeah.
I learned about light from Steve Hansen. He was very serious about
lights. Steve Hansen was a longtime New York restaurateur. Now he's in the hotel business, I think.
Yeah.
You talk about this whole idea of celebration. What do you mean by celebration?
Well, we're there for you when you're sad, too. But that's the most fun. I mean, I think for me, birthdays and anniversaries are the best. And it's such an honor when someone brings you those special occasions. And that has so many times cemented our relationship. We had a couple in this weekend who I knew had spent their – they had had their first date at our restaurant. They had gotten engaged at our restaurant. They'd had each anniversary since there. That's that's so much fun.
I love that. Like, it's at Serious Eats, we just had our 10th child born in the 13 years we've been in business.
Hey, yeah. Mazel tov.
That's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we've had kids now and marriages and I mean, among the staff and customers. And
yeah.
It's beautiful. And we see, you know, 10 years is the length of time Buttermilk Channel's been there. And that's a significant chunk of time.
It is, because restaurants are almost like websites. It's dog years. So
right.
You really you've been in business 70 years.
Yeah, it feels that way sometimes. that's a chunk of time though, in which you can see, you know, people go from like a dating couple to having kids who... I remember a kid who wasn't even born when the restaurant opened, but I knew his parents, and he you know, climbed up on the bar and asked me about the cookbook. He said, "Hey, how's it going along? When's the cookbook coming out?" I thought, "Wow, that's
awesome.
Really cool."
That's kind of funny.
So, you do this big brunch business, and you also obviously do a big dinner business. What's the difference in your minds between what a brunch service is and what a dinner service is?
Brunch is definitely more casual, even though you can have a casual experience at dinner. I mean, it's definitely like, it's almost like here's a really fancy, like, diner that's fun and come in and have drinks and kind of fun food. I always think of it as like adult kids food. I know that sounds weird, but it's like all those like kind of gluttonous, you know, fun things to eat. And it's in a pretty casual setting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we play different music. It's a little louder.
A brunch is a party.
We
could play any music at brunch too, as long as, you know, when the room is full.
Right.
We play, like, you know, all kinds of wild stuff.
Hits from the 80s, old hip hop, you know, whatever you want.
Because pancakes are the best DJ of all.
Because pancakes are at the wheel.
Yeah.
It really is a party. It's a cool thing to see. And people come from all over. It's a time when we meet people from further and further away.
Mm-hmm. And dinner is...
It's slower, for one thing. You know, dinner is a much... Brunch is really on fast forward, and dinner is a... But dinner, people are having all sorts of different experiences. Brunch is, like, always a celebration, usually. I mean, every once in a while, brunch is sad.
Yeah,
but brunch is generally a celebratory time. People are taking a break from their lives. And,
yeah. How often do you order, like, an alcoholic beverage at 10 a.m.?
Right.
You know, only on Saturday and Sunday. Okay, at brunch, you know?
I was just in Madrid, and somebody was showing me around, this guy who runs a food tour company. And at 11 a.m., we went to a vermouth bar.
Well,
yeah,
they're
serious about
vermouth. One in Spain,
vermouth.
You know.
And they have vermouth. They had 8 different kinds of vermouth on tap.
Yeah, I like that stuff.
And I said, why are we here at 11? He said, because if we get here at 11:45, we wouldn't be able to get in.
Hmm.
11 a.m., we're drinking vermouth. And I enjoyed it, don't get me wrong. But, I mean, it was something. So... I want to talk to you about something serious. It's a little bit of a change of pace. You know, there's a lot of talk and you read a lot about how hard it is to have a restaurant be profitable. Now there are changes in the minimum wage law. Every restaurateur and chef I talk to basically starts from having a very progressive set of political beliefs. And yet... Could it be a game changer for many restaurants?
Definitely for a lot of restaurants. It just officially happened at the end of it this year. So all non-tipped minimum wage employees are $15 per hour. And then tipped, the tipped wage is up to 10, which means they get 10 per hour no matter what, and then tips on top of that. You know, there's always been this formula of like your food cost is 30% and below and your beverage cost is 30% and below and then it's X, you know, blah, blah, blah. We've kind of changed our way of thinking about that. We're like, okay, labor's 40 to 45% depending on the week. How can we adjust the other percentages?
Mm-hmm.
You know, without diminishing quality.
And without raising prices too much.
Without raising prices too much. Because we don't want to be, you know, the price is going to go up. That's uncontrollable. But we don't want to be an expensive restaurant. We don't want to, like, because we're a neighborhood restaurant. We want people to still...
So is it a dance that you think you can sustain? You can hit that sweet spot?
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of chefs and restaurateurs I talk to say it's cut their margins, you know, from 10
to four.
We're in a very fortunate situation that it's just, like for French Louis, it's just Doug and myself and our wives, you know, we own the place.
Right.
So we don't have a lot of investors saying, where's my
return? Got it.
So it's really, you know, we can make decisions that maybe you wouldn't be able to make.
Interesting. So you think it's the ones where they've gotten investor money who expect returns and there's a business plan that they've all signed off on. And then if you fall short, that's when the trouble starts.
It's become difficult to be that kind of rush. I mean, yeah, there are forces that are making it a lot. Economic forces are making it a lot more difficult to have a kind of restaurant like ours, a traditional, you know, full service restaurant with a big staff and a big menu. And you see fewer and fewer of those for that reason, you know, and it's because there's no commercial rent control in the city and rents are crazy. And also now because of this, the issues with labor costs. And certainly I think we definitely support the $15 an hour minimum wage is great. I mean, you can in New York City, you can't necessarily keep above the poverty line on $15 an
right.
hour. The tip credit for tipped employees. I mean, there's a pretty powerful movement towards eliminating tipping. Which is unfortunate because that tip credit, unfortunate for us, because that tip credit is kind of a subsidy for our business that allows it to be possible. And, you know, on the other hand, I think it's been very good for the employees who are tipped. I think most of us have either been a waiter or bartender or know plenty of those people. And it's a very efficient way of making a living, you know, and also busers and food runners and stuff like that. It's a very efficient way of making a living while you're maybe a single parent or you're studying in school or something like that. And it to do away with that, which is there's a movement in that direction, I think would be very unfortunate.
Yeah, in Seattle, my friend Tom Douglas owns a bunch of restaurants, and it's very progressive politically. And, you know, he's lost a lot of employees. I think he's gone to no tipping, and people leave because they're making much less money.
Yeah, I don't believe that it's a labor movement for that reason, because I don't see, you know, the streets were filled with fast food workers striking for a $15 an hour minimum
right,
wage.
And we all understand that. Isn't the problem that we're talking about is that they're treating fast food workers the same way that they're treating tipped workers in restaurants?
I would just say, I can't necessarily speak for the whole labor force, but we don't see them coming out in favor of reducing their income through eliminating tipping. There's people make some strong arguments that they're, you know, it leaves you open to certain workplace harassment when you're working for tips. You know, that you need to put up with misbehavior because your income is not guaranteed, and that's true and should be addressed. Yeah. But I'd be sorry to see tipping go.
Yeah, yeah, and people have had mixed success, and you know. Danny Meyer is doing it now, I guess, with more and more restaurants. But he's acknowledged that it's cost him business.
Yeah, I'm sure it has.
It's cost him employees, too.
And lots of huge employee turnover.
I mean, there were restaurants, in that company where they were making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they can't possibly make that much money once the playing field gets more leveled or once they're no longer making gratuities.
So now it's time for the All You Can Answer special sauce buffet. Who's at your last supper? No family allowed.
Chef-wise, I'll take Anthony Bourdain.
Okay.
He can come back and sit at my table.
All right.
I'll do Mike Patton for a musician. But he loves
Who
food.
Who is Michael Patton? I was in the music business for a long time.
He's most well-known for being lead singer of Faith No More.
Ah, okay.
But he does a lot of other things, too.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
I'll throw John Zorn in there, too.
John Zorn. We're getting pretty idiosyncratic there. Who else?
This looks dead
bad.
Or alive?
This looks
you said
bad.
We said
yeah.
Do,
yeah,
those
yeah.
rules?
Yeah. Anyone, could be Joan of Arc. I don't care.
Joan of Arc. How about Molly Ringwald?
Yeah. No,
Molly Ringwald.
She's very charming. She'd
bring a nice 80s perspective to the
Joan
whole
thing. Of Arc could bring cake.
You just made it was a beautiful table. I was sorry we couldn't be family members because there's some people I'd really like to eat with there.
No, but we had to eliminate that because everyone.
Because that's too sure.
I would like to have your wife at my last supper.
That's a great call. That's a great call. I thought George Saunders, who we make reference to in that book, he's got some perspectives on death.
George Saunders. Wow, man, that is some literary. cred, man, you just got yourself. That's good.
He would. I mean, it's gonna be a pretty dark meal. I'm gonna need someone to give me a perspective on what lies ahead.
And, you know? And what are you eating? What would you guys be eating at this Last Supper?
It's pizza. Yes, pizza.
Really,
pizza.
Pizza. It's the last time I get to eat pizza. I'm gonna eat pizza.
All right. Would you, like pizza from Raza? Like
I opened a can of worms with you. I don't.
It's almost any
Can you
pizza.
Consult on my pizza?
Yes, I would consult on your pizza.
Yeah, maybe a buffet. I might want like a regular New York slice. I might want a Sicilian in there. I may want like the Neapolitan, you know, as well.
I would definitely consult. Like gratis, I'll come up with a pizza menu for you.
It's an important meal.
You'd have to have Chris Bianco's pistachio nut, red onion, and Parmigiano Reggiano pizza. Called the Rosa.
Is he in Arizona?
Yeah.
Does that mean my last meal in this world
no,
is in Arizona?
No, we're going to get Chris here.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chris.
Chris is going to be here. We'll find him an oven. He'll make you a Rosa. It'll change your life.
There we go. Ryan?
I'm picturing this being like an all-day meal.
Yeah, of course.
I'm going to drag it out. Yeah.
And since I was just at Barney Greengrass, can we start with some smoked fish?
Of course. Are we talking sturgeon or salmon?
I mean, if it's from Barney Greengrass, it's got to be sturgeon.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. So what do you both cook, and this you can answer individually, when there's nothing in the house to eat? What will there always be that you can rustle up?
Oh, I don't cook anything. It's saltines, hot sauce, butter, and mackerel. Canned no, mackerel. That's always in my house.
So a tin of mackerel?
Yeah.
All right.
Saltines, butter's essential. And some hot sauce.
I love that. And you, Doug?
Yeah, we're both eating oily fishes. For me, it would be like a meal you can entirely make out of a bodega and stuff in your pantry, like linguine with anchovies, capers, olive oil, red pepper flakes.
It'd be a total umami bomb.
Oh, yeah. And the more anchovies, the better.
Do each of you have a guilty pleasure that you'll own up to on Special Sauce?
Like weird things that we like to eat that we don't tell anyone.
Yeah,
about.
Like bugles or.
Oh, bugles are fantastic. And Fritos are they the ones that are really good?
Yeah but Fritos, you know, man. No one. I just brought up bugles, but the fact that you love bugles really says something.
Yeah, they're beautiful. There's certain things like there are certain places where the American food industry has really worked some magic. Like what's it? What even is a Triscuit? Like, how do they make that with like a dough loom? But it's like woven dough. But it's that's like wonderful.
It's pure like genius.
That. But that's not guilty. I feel like ketchup is a guilty pleasure.
I know.
Because it's so weird. It's so weird that we even have that in our restaurant.
But I hope you guys serve Heinz ketchup, or do you make your own?
No, Heinz.
Thank you. Because by the way, you can't do any better than the Heinz.
No.
But isn't that weird? It's like high fructose corn syrup.
I know.
I mean, that's a strange thing. That's one you could feel guilty about because it's weird. But so, it's delicious. Yeah.
So what's on your nightstand right now, Doug, book-wise?
I'm reading stories by William Trevor stories, you know, great old Irish writer. And I'm also reading Philip Pullman, so like YA fantasy.
And your wife is publishing a YA novel.
She is. All the Greys on Green Street comes out in June, and it's the most exciting thing that's happening.
Coming to a bookstore near you. What about you? What's in your nightstand?
Nightstand, I have this new cookbook about Robata grilling.
Uh-huh.
It's in there. And then, well, we just went to Japan, and we're going back, so I've been on this Japanese kick. So
all right, we didn't even talk about this, but you opened up a buttermilk channel in Japan.
Yeah, that happened.
They love fried chicken, too.
Yeah.
They're crazy about pancakes.
They're crazy about
pancakes.
And how long has it been open now?
Since October, beginning October.
And it's going great?
It's going great, yeah. I see it every day on Instagram. And we have
that's awesome.
And we have, shaky Skype meetings. And
and how often do you guys have to go over there?
We'll be back in April.
Got it. Yeah. And you go for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, we'll be there for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Fried chicken has become like the favorite Christmas meal in Japan. Did you have a big run on fried chicken? Were you open Christmas?
We actually are responsible for that phenomenon. No, we're not. KFC is credited with inventing a phenomenon of fried chicken.
Right.
I just
there.
Read that recently. It's like a big thing. And I was wondering if there was going to be a big one, but I didn't hear. Did you hear anything that it was like exceptionally like?
It's a big holiday for them. It's a big, like, there's like 2 weeks, Christmas, New Year's, of big holiday time there. And yeah, there was a lot of fried chicken sold. But I think the specific tradition is in buckets, is getting that bucket of
right.
chicken and bringing
so,
it home.
Yeah,
we don't have that.
You don't really want to eat your fried chicken at KFC.
You don't want to eat at KFC.
Yeah.
No, you got to take it away.
Yeah,
although maybe in
it
Tokyo,
away.
Maybe the KFC may be beautiful. I didn't see one. 7-Elevens
yeah,
are lovely there.
7-Elevens are great.
So what's the most influential book that you've ever read? It could be about cooking or food, or it could be just about anything.
Cooking-wise, that one that came out, The Perfectionist, think about that one a lot.
Oh, that was about the 3-star Michelin chef who committed suicide when the Michelin folks demoted him to 2 stars. I think the chef's name was Bernard Loiselle.
Yeah, Loiseau, yeah.
That was a powerful book,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, that was a good book.
Yeah, very sad. What about you, Doug?
Okay, fiction will be fiction, maybe?
Yeah, fiction is good.
I'll take Portrait of a Lady.
Portrait of a Lady.
Yeah, sure. I'll take Portrait of a Lady. I think both these books are like showed us directions not to go in, how not to lead an utterly miserable life.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, who's had the greatest influence on your careers?
I mean, for me, it's Mike Fennelly. He's a chef that I worked for when my first job in San Francisco. I'm still friends with him to this day, like 25 years later.
And is he still a restaurant there?
No, now he lives in Maine. He's an artist. He's a chef and artist. He does a lot more painting now. I think he just opened up like a cafe in his backyard, because that's what he does, called like Wabi Cafe. But he was the most influential. He just taught me like a very, I don't know, very nice way of cooking.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Dad?
I never worked for Danny Meyer, but he put into words through his book, through Setting the Table, you know, a lot about hospitality and sort of kindness and compassion that we strive for in our restaurants. He put that very eloquently into words in that book, and that was a big influence on
me. Yeah, that's a great book. You know, when I was looking for books that would be like mine, I, of course, thought of Danny's book, and then I love that book, and I love how personal it was, and I love the fact that he says, I didn't interview anybody else for this book. You know, these are my thoughts and my feelings. And he also gets very personal about, you know, his family. And so there are elements of that in my book, but there wasn't any book out there that was going to be like mine. It's one of those things when you open a restaurant or when you write a book, you actually don't know what it's going to be until you're done.
Yeah, I mean, like you can't have too rigid of an idea about what it's going to be.
Yeah,
I think all authors talk about that. There's an element of unconscious of some, you know.
It's weird, and I had no idea because at first I thought I was going to write like a prescriptive business book, but then your wife laughed at me. She's like, "No, like your book would be how not to run a business." And so then
she's
like,
"Like it is." Huh?
So then it'd be like, okay, so and then at the end, I said, I finally just realized what the book was about.
Which is?
The book is about a guy who had a crazy idea, who had some rough moments growing up, and went from surviving to thriving through achieving a near impossible dream.
Hey, fantastic pitch! I'll take it.
It's my elevator pitch.
What's your most influential book?
I've never had anyone ask me that before, even though I ask everybody else that question. I know. There's a book that I love that a lot of people don't even know about, written by Ron Suskind, a beautiful nonfiction writer, called A Hope in the Unseen, which is about a kid who graduates from a high school in one of the worst neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., he goes to Brown on a scholarship and what he encounters. It is such an extraordinary book. It's such an inspirational book. Really, I will tell you, if my book, now that it's over, it would be the closest thing to A Hope in the Unseen. You know, just that movement from surviving to thriving that is in my book is also in that book. If you ever get a chance to read it, it's still in print. It's called A Hope in the Unseen.
Hey, well, I will now.
It's got some Rhode Island references. That's
nice. Yeah. Yeah, it's got a lot of Rhode Island references. All right. So last question. It's just been declared, and in your case, it's Doug and Ryan Day all over the world.
Mm.
What's happening on that day?
Please don't tell me there's fried chicken.
I didn't say that.
We're in charge of the world.
Yeah,
on this
you're
day?
In charge. Everyone does what you think they should be doing.
I'm not prepared for that question.
Everyone shuts off their phones.
Okay.
Oh, that's nice.
That's good. Are they cooking? Are they eating? Are they playing?
Everyone is eating pizza with Henry James, or what would we say? with George Saunders and the guy and John Zorn.
I love it. All right, man. Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Doug Kroll and Ryan Angulo. Do pick up a copy of their Much More Than a Cookbook, Kindness and Salt, Recipes for the Care and Feeding of Your Friends and Neighbors. And if you find yourself in Brooklyn, you could do far worse than breaking bread at either Buttermilk Channel or French Louis. You will be greeted with kindness, and your food will be properly salted. Thanks, gentlemen. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Ed.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ed.